Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Paul Garcia Show. I'm your host, Paul Garcia, and I speak to remarkable people from Central Illinois about their incredible lives and valuable insights. Today, I have a very special guest. He's a man that most of you may know as a teacher from Prairie Central High School or a professor from Illinois State University. However, we're going to talk about something that you might not know him for today, and that's his up-close and personal journey with breast cancer, one that sadly took his wife's life. Paul Meister, I sincerely appreciate your time coming on today, and even more so your bravery in doing this, talking about what I presume to be a really difficult topic. So, long story short, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, absolutely, Paul. It's good to be back on.
Yeah.
I know we talked about this a month or so ago, maybe a bit longer, but... And you had asked me a while ago, I think it was 2 years ago maybe, is the first time I was on your show, which you've progressed since then. We talked about that earlier on. But and we kind of talked about the hard conversation. And it's definitely important. Obviously, as we all know, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. I mentioned to you early on, too, that I never really have shared my story, the whole story, I don't think, with anybody. I think it's time. It's a lengthy story, but with an unfortunate ending. But there are a lot of good things along the way for sure. So thanks for having me on again.
Hey, the pleasure, the honor is all mine. It really is. And let me, before we just go ahead and dive right into it, you told me in that Facebook message that this is really important. Therefore, we should talk about it. And as you said, you haven't really talked about this publicly before. So why is it so important, do you think, besides the fact that it is October Breast Cancer Awareness Month?
Yeah, it's important. I mean, cancer unfortunately touches so many people's lives. And I mean, everybody knows everybody, or I shouldn't say everybody, everybody knows somebody that's unfortunately, you know, had to battle with cancer. No matter what kind it is. I mean, obviously, we're here to talk more specifically about breast cancer, but It's unfortunate. It's an unfortunate part of lots of people's lives, and I think a lot of times that we talk about it and we bring awareness to it, and especially we see this in a lot of major sports, for example. You know, I'm a big NFL fan, and we see that they talk about, you know, Cancer Awareness Month, or it used to be just breast cancer, and now I think it's cancer awareness or whatever it is. But I don't think that we talk too much about the true impact on people's lives and the true impact that it has, you know, on a lot of people, and because it's a hard conversation. It's a hard conversation. It's scary. And especially when we talk about young people. You know, my wife was very young. It's not something that you ever think about. And I think that the awareness and just having those conversations, and we'll get into the more, you know, nitty gritty of that in a bit. But it's very important to have those conversations. And you never know when, you know, you might talk to somebody or have a conversation with someone who's going through something similar or has gone through something similar, and you can connect and you know, share those stories, and you know that you're not alone, that there are people that, you know, help you out that may have shared the same thing.
Right. It seems like those daunting conversations are precisely the ones that you need to have more often and more deeply even. That all said, you said your wife was young, which is particularly difficult to deal with. Let's give people maybe a timeline. I think that'd be useful. Could you tell us, maybe even starting with when you met your wife, Heather? When did that happen, and then we can go from there?
Yeah, absolutely. So that alone is kind of a crazy story. So as I met her in New Year's Eve 2009, and I was second year teaching at Prairie Central High School, and I had no interest whatsoever in getting to know anyone, getting to meet anyone. I was fully engrossed in my job. I was coaching at the time. We talked about that last time, I think. And
basketball, right?
Coaching basketball, yeah. So I really did. I was very busy, and I didn't really have any interest in meeting anyone and at that particular time. And a friend of mine contacted me, and a shout out to Mike Wolf, who teaches at, well, he's an administrator now at PC, and we were friends at the time, and he said, hey, we're having a New Year's Eve party, you should really come. And I said, I don't know. Well, he texted me last minute again and said, man, you should really come down. I said, okay, fine. And as it turns out, Heather was friends with his wife, Nikki, and she had said the same thing, I guess. That, oh, you should bring, you know, her, Heather's sister Ashley, and she said you should bring her along, and she didn't want to go either. And it turns out she had just moved back from California. She had lived in California for 3 years, and so we both ended up going to this party where we didn't really want to be there, and obviously that turned out quite well. And so we connected that night, and things kind of progressed pretty quickly from there, and we started dating, and then in August of 2010, she was diagnosed. So, and there's even more stories within that. She had found a lump on her breast in, I believe it was April, and at that time it wasn't very large. It was not a big thing, and she was 24 years old. 27, sorry, I got that date wrong, 27 years old, and so young, right? Not a big deal. And she went to her doctor, and the doctor said, the doctor said just that. Well, you're young. Let's just keep an eye on it, and let's not be too terribly concerned. I was quite concerned, and so I said, well, I think you should probably get another opinion. And by the time that she was able to get into another doctor to get another opinion, it was in August. And by then, there was some more significant changes. And so then the day she was diagnosed, I don't remember the exact date, but it was the first day of classes on my second year of teaching high school. And I got a phone call from her, and she said, yeah, it's cancer. And so that immediately was obviously a huge shock. It was quite a surprise. And not just was it cancer, Paul, but it was stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer, which is one of the most aggressive cancers there are for breast cancer.
Just to clarify, how many stages even are there?
Stage 4 means that it spread to other organs. So a first stage, stage 1, would be that it's located to a specific region. It's easier to take out with surgery. And then I don't know all of the other stages, but I do know stage 4 means that it spread to other locations in the body. And so she had not only at that point had it in her breast, but she had it in lymph nodes. And they discovered right shortly after that in her liver as well. And so it was rather aggressive very early on.
Wow. How old were you at this point? And you'd been together just over a year then?
Yeah, not quite a year. Oh. Pardon me. We'd gotten together New Year's Eve, and then this was August of 2010. So just a few months, 9 months. Mm-hmm. And so I was 30 at the time. And okay. So it was, it was quite a surprise. And again, this is why I think it's important to talk about this, because when you're 30, you don't think about that, right? You're young, you're invincible seemingly, and that's not something you think about. And especially when the doctors at the time were reassuring her and saying, yeah, it's, you know, don't worry too much. And then obviously that it took a turn for the worse.
Okay. Well, we could go a lot of different directions here, but just to continue on with this story then. So it's the first day of your second year of teaching, and you get this probably the most powerful phone call you've ever gotten, and it's from your wife, and she's telling you that she has stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer. What do you do? How does your life change at that point? What's the next step? What was her attitude even? Just tell me it all.
Her attitude, and actually we'll talk more about this, but she was an absolutely incredible, incredible human being. I really, honestly, Paul, to this day, do not know how she fought the battle she fought with the attitude she had, and I'll share a few more stories as we go on with this. But her attitude was absolutely incredible, and I said, my first response obviously was, "Oh, are you kidding me? Like, I'm going to come home right now. We need to be together." And she said, "No." She said, "It's day one. You need to be there. There's nothing you can do about it now. We'll talk when you get home." Her attitude throughout this whole thing, Paul, I've never seen anybody fight with so much grace and just courage, and never, ever heard her complain. And we'll talk about the whole length of the battle here. It was incredible. And mine, I drew strength from that. And so knowing that she knew my passion for teaching, and so she said, no, you need to go back. And I fortunately at that time had block one prep, and so I had a little bit of time to kind of get my head right and to to focus on what I needed to focus on. And, you know, I talk to my students now. I teach a teaching class at ISU, and I talk to them about not bringing your personal battles into the classroom if you can help it, because, you know, I think it's important that those kind of stay separate. Your students are your students. And so I did just that. I went and I focused on teaching that day, and it was incredibly, incredibly difficult, of course, but knowing that she had my back essentially was huge. Knowing that that's what she wanted me to do, and it was a tough day, and I'd like to think that my students didn't know. I'm sure they knew. You know, maybe something was a little bit off, it was a rough day.
It's you know, I wouldn't be surprised if this is the first episode that I tear up on, because I wrote in you saw that plaque over there. I don't mean to sound like a show off or anything, but like there's a 20 under 40 plaque, and they interviewed me for this magazine. In the magazine, you saw is who's your favorite teacher, most influential teacher? I said it was you, and largely because, you know, yeah, you broke some rules and you were fun, you were very intelligent, you encouraged curiosity, but also only a while into, like probably after I graduated, honestly, did I find out that you were dealing with this battle with your wife in her terminal breast cancer. And that just like made my respect for you skyrocket. I didn't know. How did you come to school and act the way you acted? You seemed like you were on cloud nine, actually. Like, this guy's got it together. He's got a great head on his shoulders. He's energetic. Like, I want to be like that. The fact that you were going through something more difficult than I've ever gone through while being that way was puzzling, and it's also more than inspiring. So I bet I'm 99% of the students didn't know anything was going on unless you told them at some point. Anyway, though, just wanted to say that because I sure didn't know, and it sure makes you even more inspiring. And I take that with me. I take that lesson that you showed me with me. Anyway, I guess what I want to say is thank you, and I think it's pretty cool, and I respect that a lot.
Well, thanks a lot, Paul. And we talked, you know, before we got on here too, that the 20 under 40, and that's awesome. But I certainly do appreciate the callback to teaching. The reason why I did that, Paul, was because it was hard. I mean, there's no doubt about that. There was a lot of days where it was very, very challenging, and students did find out later on, and again, you know, we'll get a little bit more into that too. But it was tough. But I drew a lot of strength from her and her attitude. There's something that she said very often, and I never quite understood it until after. And she really never came out and told people often that she had cancer, that she was fighting cancer, and I never quite got that. But then she would always say, well, I don't want people to look at me differently. And now I understand that, because, you know, it's a tough thing, and you want to be known for you, right? Not for something else, the disease or whatever. And she always called it the sad eyes. And I saw it so many times when people would find out, you know, and so I guess I drew a lot of strength from that. And I tried not to bring that into the classroom. Because I feel very strongly that students they all fight their own battles, and you never know what someone's going through. And so I always try and think about that. And I try to maintain a positive attitude, because your students need that. And, you know, if how that is, if you're around, you know, negative people or people that are down or sad, it's probably going to influence you in that way too. And I didn't want to do that to my students. That wasn't fair to them. And so, no, I actually didn't tell my students for many months, actually. The administration knew, my coworkers knew, but I don't think many students, if any, knew at all, because of that reason. I wanted to keep that separate. And I'd also do a shout out to the Prairie Central administration at that time. They were fantastic when they found out, when I told them, specifically Dan Casillas. I mean, he was absolutely fantastic, very supportive. And so I couldn't have asked for more from that front too. When you go into administration, you're in year two and you're thinking, oh man, what's going to happen to me, to my job? How much time am I going to have to take off? And when your administrator tells you, don't worry, I got you, like that's pretty awesome. And so it was that certainly helped. And my coworkers at the time were the same way. I mean, they had my back. So all of that certainly helped to maintain that positive attitude, knowing that I had support certainly from the school district.
It's a fantastic district. Prairie Central is amazing. I had Paula Crane on recently, and she's wonderful, and she spoke in a way that just lit up the whole town of Fairbury, it seemed. So, yeah, great administration. Dan Casillas is a man. I talked to him recently at the state wrestling tournament. He's a good guy. He's a tough guy, and he's a great guy, though. So what was the attitude then moving forward for both of you? What were you thinking? Stage four's not good. But as you said, this was a long journey. It lasted a long time. What did you guys decide to do after you went home after that first day and you talked over a game plan? What was the game plan?
Well, that's an interesting question, Paul, because I did something that I probably should not have done. In that, I'm a scientist. I'm research-minded. Of course, I started researching. And so that was probably the worst thing that I did, because I started going down that rabbit hole of cancer research on the internet, and it was scary. I didn't know what to do, because I thought, I see all of these statistics and I see all of the survival rates and I see all these other things, and yeah, I was terrified, and we didn't really know what to do, and especially how to have those conversations. But again, I go back to this, and I'm going to repeat myself a lot on this, but she was so incredibly strong, Paul. Like I can't even begin to tell you her attitude, excuse me, her attitude throughout this whole process was just so incredible. And so I remember of going down this rabbit hole, and at the time also we were talking about, she didn't know this, but I was talking to one of my close friends about getting engaged. And so I met with him, and as it turns out, he's an oncologist, and so he told me a lot of things that really helped me out. He said, you know, don't he of course he told me after I went on the internet, but he said stay off the internet. He said that's not a good spot to be. You hear all these horror stories, and everybody's case is different, and you know, you have to find what's right for you, and that really helped me out. And then the second part to that too is, we got admitted to the cancer center here in town. At that time, it was the Community Cancer Center. I think now it's part of the Carl system. And Paul, I cannot speak highly enough about those folks. The doctors, the nurses there are absolutely incredible. To this day, as a matter of fact, I still talk to some of them. They are utmost professionals. They make you feel like a human. You know, a lot of times when you go into the doctor's office, you can, you know, it's in and out, and they act like, you know, sometimes they think, you get the feeling of, well, they're not really there for me. It's just a business.
Number type of thing.
Exactly. And there, that was not the case from day one. And more specifically, and he might get mad at me for dropping his name, but Dr. Migas there was her oncologist. And Paul, he was an absolutely phenomenal, is an absolutely phenomenal doctor and human being. We were never just a number. I remember our very first meeting with him. He was late, very late. But it was towards the end of the day, and of course, when you're in a doctor's office and you want to get, you know, started and whatever, and I was getting a little bit frustrated, and then once he came into the room and started talking to us, I realized why he was late, and since then, that's never upset me that a doctor's been late, because he took all of the time to answer all of our questions, to make sure that we were comfortable, to make sure that we understood everything there was to know about her current diagnosis.
That's a good doctor, man.
It was incredible, Paul. And of course, I had a million questions and a notepad full of questions. And so he sat with us for a very long time and walked us through the step-by-step process, how things were going to work, what the next steps were. And so, yeah, it was, we're very lucky to have that resource in our community. Hmm.
Okay. So then the game plan moving forward, like after that meet up with the doctor, you got all your questions answered, presumably, then what? And again, I ask, you know, as we go down these chapters, an update on your morale through it all. Were you hopeful?
Yeah, absolutely. At that time, I stopped researching on the internet. And then, yeah, after meeting with him, I felt very comfortable. I felt, yeah, we have a game plan. we're gonna do this thing, and everything is gonna be great. And so game plan was put her on chemo and start the first rounds of treatment, shrink the tumor, and then surgery to remove the remainder of the surgery. And if radiation was needed, then radiation. And the first round, she responded very, very well to treatment. It shrunk the tumor dramatically. There was no real signs left of cancer in her liver or lymph nodes. They then did surgery. They did mastectomy and removed all of the cancer tissue and removed a few lymph nodes. And again, throughout that whole process, so incredibly strong. Always had an upbeat, positive attitude. Paul, I wish that I could have that attitude every day that she had. I always went into the doctor's office as a ball of nerves. You never know what's going to happen. You never know what they're going to say. And so I was always the nervous one, and I was always worked up and tense and anxious, and she was every time was just like, we're going to get through this. It's okay. And so she was the one comforting me, not the other way around, which is pretty incredible. And, So we had a game plan.
Why do you think that is? Just curious. How was she so strong through that all?
I really honestly don't know, Paul. I don't know. I don't think that's something I probably will never know.
She didn't have some kind of slogan or anything that she would say all the time?
No, she was just so strong. And I don't know where. I'm going to scoot ahead for just a little bit, and then we'll come back to this. But so ultimately, she battled for 7 years. And Paul, in those 7 years, I saw her go through more procedures, more, you name it, more rounds of chemo, more everything than anyone should ever have to do. And I never heard her complain one single time. Not once. As a matter of fact, the other day I was trying to think about, am I making this up? But it just never did she complain. There was only one time, and it was because of a medication she took that gave her kind of an altered mental state, let's say. And after it happened, she apologized, and she said, "I'm so sorry I complained, and I'm so sorry I was a whiner." She's like, "I shouldn't have done that." So one time in 7 years. I really honestly, Paul, do not know. I complain about the weather sometimes. I complain about, whatever it may be. And I'd like to think that I try to maintain a pretty positive attitude. But I don't know, Paul. I don't know if I'll ever know that. But I learned a lot through that. Seeing her stuck with so many needles and so many treatments and what that did to her, never, ever once complained. So where that came from, she was just an incredible human being. It's pretty crazy.
Just hearing that makes me, I feel like I'm inclined to complain a little less now. If someone can, I complain about the stupidest things. Sometimes it's embarrassing. I could complain about this table having too much dust on it.
Yeah.
Like, man, this room's a little too cold. My eyes get watery. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
But no, and that's, we'll talk again more, I'm sure, towards the end here, but I learned a lot from that. I really did because of just that, right? I mean, we are inclined to complain a lot about just the small things. But I think, though, too, when you put things in perspective and you understand that, okay, this is a life-altering thing, the little stuff becomes minute. The little things that we may complain about become very minute.
Right.
So her attitude throughout the whole process at the very beginning, absolutely fantastic. She was like, let's do this. We have a game plan. And every time, it didn't matter if we had good or bad news, Paul. Every time, and that, I guess maybe that is one thing that she would say all the time, is we have a game plan. We're like, I know what the next steps are, and that makes me feel comfortable. And so once we got that first stuff out of the way and she started taking chemo and did surgery, I think it made her feel more comfortable because she knew she had a game plan. And so we went from there.
Yeah. I mean, psychologically, I've talked to a lot of psychology people on the show and read some books on this, but if you have something to look forward to, you have a game plan, that is everything.
Yeah.
You see it all the time, actually, sadly. When people retire from their jobs, a lot of times they die soon after, because if you don't have that thing to... Yeah. Like, it's like you ratchet onto a thing and pull yourself towards it, and you strive for something, the next thing, the next thing. If you don't have that, what have you got, you know?
Exactly. And she actually mentioned that often, too, is that, you know, that having those game plans, and not just that. I'm a firm believer, Paul, that her positive attitude, I don't have any doubt that it extended her life. I really don't. Because ultimately, and now if we go back and look at statistics, you know, that kind of diagnosis is a short period. And
how short?
A couple of years. And of course, statistics are, I mean, you can take it for what it's worth. But if I recall correctly, and it's been a long time since I've looked at this, but it's, I think on average it was 2 years or less. And her battle lasted seven. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I really firmly believe that her positive attitude certainly had some effect on that. And you talk about psychology. There's a lot of things too that will, you know, a negative mindset can impact negatively on your body. Stress, anxiety, all that stuff. You know, that can certainly impact, you know, your health. Your not just your physical, or sorry, your mental health, but your physical health as well.
Oh yeah, biologically. I mean, neurochemically, it's not even that mysterious.
Right.
It's like, yeah, you
right.
get these cortisol spikes or these whatever, not endorphins, but whatever the opposite of that is. But yeah, anyway, yep. I totally agree with you. Science agrees with you, yep. Of course. But okay, you said that the first round of chemo, and I don't know if you said radiation or not, but it went well. Did it continue to get more frequent, or apparently it wasn't enough in that first one? It didn't shrink enough. You said there was no visible cancer. So what happened after that then?
So after that, she responded very, very well, had surgery. She did not need radiation the first time. If I don't recall, there's been so many different treatments and surgeries that I'm probably losing track of some of them. But so after, I think it was three months was the first cycle of treatments. And the cancer responded very well to that treatment at that time. After just a few months, she was in quote remission. And I think that I learned a lesson in that too, that remission is not ultimately truly cancer free in some cases. And of course I'm no doctor, and I don't know all of the medical terms, but, the way it was explained to us was that there may still be some cancer cells there, but they're not detectable at the present moment. And so that was fantastic news, right? I mean, we had, you know, great news after just a couple short months. And of course, then you immediately think, okay, good, we're out of the weeds. We're good to go. And that's it. That's kind of, we just need to make sure that we maintain for the extent, for who knows, right? And the timing of that worked out very, very well, because as it turns out, we got engaged in November. So she was diagnosed in August. We got engaged in November. And then we were scheduled to be married in the following November. And so by the time she got her first remission diagnosis, she was cancer free for our wedding. And so it was a blessing. It was great. Turned out perfect. And then of course it came back. So, and that was, I don't remember the date. So from the first time to the last, a lot of that is a blur. But it came back. And of course, I think, Paul, the second time was harder than the first, I'll be honest. Because the first time was just such an utter shock. You don't think that'll happen at that young of an age. And when you hear those words, but then all of a sudden, you know, you get that game plan and you get the treatment and things were going well. And in my mind, I thought, okay, this is, you know, that's behind us now. We don't have to worry about that anymore. And that's not what happened. And so it was, the second time was rougher. And partially, I think maybe because of, you know, she would get, you know, checkups every month or two. And she would get scans to see if anything was going on. And, you know, when you're sitting in the doctor's office physically, and we're thinking, okay, everything's in the clear, everything's good, and they tell you it's back. That's tough. It's really tough. So the second time was, I would say for me harder than the first, and probably too because there wasn't that immediate focus on, you know, my students and the kids. We are there in the doctor's office, and again, I remember leaving that time too, and you know, I'm bawling. Of course, I'm a mess. And she looked at me and said, "It's going to be okay." And I don't know how. I have no idea. I have no idea how, Paul. Like I'm the nervous wreck. I'm the one that's, you know, bawling my eyes out. And here she is saying it's going to be okay. Didn't shed a tear. And again,
really?
And again, I don't know where that is. And I do not know where that strength came from. I really don't. And now I think, you know, and she was probably being strong for myself and her family. I really do think that. And I do want to throw that out there too, that her family is absolutely fantastic, fantastic human beings. And so I can see where a lot of that came from. Her parents are just absolutely wonderful people. She's got one sister, Ashley, and she's fantastic. So I think some of that strength probably was drawn from that as well. But yeah, I don't know how she did that. But yeah, second time. And so I thought, here we go again. The treatment the second time worked again. No surgeries needed, fortunately. And it took a little longer for the chemo to work this time. But the first time, I think it was about 3 months until... when I say 3 months, I back up for a second. The first 3 months, it's a 6 month treatment. So every 2 weeks for 3 months, and then they do a scan, and then they wanted to make sure they got everything. So I think they did it 3 months again of chemo, every 2 weeks, and then the second time around, it took about a year for her to go back into remission again. And so she went into remission again, and then so the first remission lasted about a year ish. And then the second one, so she did treatment again. Second one then lasted just a few months. I think it was maybe 6 months-ish. And then it came back a third time.
Let me ask one thing just for clarification. Chemo and radiation, is chemo when you take, pills? What is chemo and then what is radiation in a really brief nutshell, just so people know what to picture?
Sure, yeah. So chemo can be pills. There's a variety of different options, and of course, you know, things have changed now a little bit. Primarily, they're injected intravenously. So you go to the cancer center, and it depends on the type of chemo that they give you. There's a variety of side effects, right? I mean, primarily, a lot of them make you lose your hair. They can make you really sick for a week or two, if not longer, depending on, you know, your age and the cancer and the type of chemo. It ultimately is poison. Chemo really is poison, but it's delivered in a dose that, you know, is supposed to kill the cancer cells, not the normal cells, because they're healthy enough to hopefully stay healthy. And that's really why it makes you sick and makes you nauseous. And it's just... it does such terrible things to the body, Paul. I mean, and there are some that, you know, that you can't take. I know she did try taking a pill form once, and it was awful. It did such terrible things, made her lose a ton of weight, lose her appetite, and so she had to go off of that one. And really, a lot of times, quite frankly, it's almost the trial and error. I mean, you know, we have these chemos that we know work. But will it work for your particular instance? And so thankfully the first couple, you know, worked quite well. But yeah, it was, and you get it every couple of weeks. And again, dependent on the type of chemo, there can be a 2 week period or 3 week period, depending on how long that poison stays in your system and how it makes you feel. Hmm. And there are some that, you know, have to be injected over a really lengthy period of time. And this is the scary part, Paul, is that, she took one that, and I don't remember any of the names, of course, but they had to be injected over a really slow period of time, because if it was injected too rapidly, it could destroy your veins. And that's how to me, crazy this stuff is, right? That it is really, truly poison.
It could, like, deteriorate your vein?
Right, yeah, around the injection site specifically, yeah. It's some nasty stuff. But, of course, it does, you know, I mean, it's vital. And the chemo certainly and treatment options certainly have improved over the last decade or so. So I don't know the options are available now, but that was what she had to go through, yeah.
And then radiation.
Radiation is ultimately bombarding the cancer site or the tumor site with radioactive energy. And so what it does ultimately is it kills the DNA in the cancer cells, kills the cells, and I might be way off on the science on that, but that's my knowledge of it. And again, the cancer center here in town, they have state-of-the-art treatment options. And so their radiation is so specifically targeted, it's crazy.
It sounds like they're just hitting your body with something that's almost lethal, but not enough to kill you, but hopefully the cancer.
That's exactly right. And so that's why it makes you feel like, you know, feel terrible. That's why it makes you lose your hair. And again, I don't know all of the science. I look at rocks, so I don't know. I don't know the science behind the biology behind that. But yeah, it's essentially poison, and it's some pretty awful stuff. Some of the things that it does to your body, and you know, even things like there's something called chemo brain, that there's a blood brain barrier that protects our brains from a lot of different toxins and things like that. And chemo supposedly is not supposed to cross that barrier, if I remember correctly. But it causes chemo brain or brain fog, and so forgetfulness and things like that, and things that you don't even think about like that. So it's pretty harsh stuff.
Now, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to know, I think sometimes when people know the struggles of someone they admire a lot, it makes them feel less guilty and shameful about their own struggles. So what was seeing your wife go through this like for you, and how did you react, particularly if you reacted negatively or you just felt some negative emotions? What was that like for you? How did you respond?
Man, that's a good question. I drew a lot of power or strength from her. The way she reacted, we really tried very, very hard to live our lives as normal as possible. And obviously that's very challenging to do, when, you know, every second or third weekend, you know, she's home in bed cause she, you know, doesn't feel well, and she doesn't, you know, she's fighting off the chemo, and she's, you know, battling the cancer. And so it's very, very hard, but we tried to live our life as quote normal as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's tough, but a lot of that was certain. We made a promise to ourselves very, very early on that we were not going to let cancer rule our lives, that we were going to do the normal things as much as we possibly could. We were going to carry on about our quote, normal lives as much as we possibly could. And so we really tried to live that. But it's tough, Paul. I mean, the emotional roller coaster. And quite frankly, I don't think I realized the toll that it took on me until after the fact. Because when I was in it, I had one main focus, and that was on her, to make sure that she was comfortable, make sure that she was doing okay, to take care of her. And that was my focus. I didn't really care so much about what happened in my life outside of that, because I focused on her. And I regret some things in life, but that's something I will never regret. That I wholeheartedly supported her, whatever she needed, whatever she wanted. I focused 100% on her. And again, we had a great support cast with her family and her friends and my family. So that certainly helped as well. But the main toll, for me, was the ups and downs of the doctor's appointments. I mean, because you'd go in, you'd get good news, and you'd be excited, right? And you'd be, okay, we got this. And then, you know, a month or two later, you'd go in and get bad news. And so that emotional roller coaster was pretty tough to deal with. But
first of all, it almost seems like it could be a blessing if you're in the midst of something terrible like this to have the obligation to care for someone else. So your attention is put on them rather than allowed to wander throughout this negative circumstance. And then this sounds like you would be living in anxiety. If I had to go to a doctor's appointment that had this much weight on it monthly, and I'd have to wait, you know, 29 days each time before getting a mystery verdict, that would drive me insane.
But Oh, yeah.
It didn't drive you insane. Or at least not your wife.
Well, me, yes, not her. And again, right. I don't know how. I think she always just had this mindset of, you know, whatever happens is going to happen, and we're going to deal with it. Because I would always be just stressed to the max, especially, you know, the day of the doctor's appointment. And we would say, how do you feel? And what? And there'd be all these things. And then, you know, she'd be like, don't stress about it. She's like, when we get there, we'll find out and we'll deal with it. And So for me, I was absolutely stressed to the max every time, you know, massive anxiety. But I do agree with you that, you know, for me to focus on her and her needs and making sure that I wasn't going too far overboard, really helped. I think maybe, I can't remember a time where it was the opposite way around, where she was the one that was anxious and I was the one that wasn't. And again, maybe because she was the one that was going through it and she knew in her head, you know, what she had to do. But yeah, it's the anxiety level certainly absolutely through the roof, yeah.
Do you think that maybe, just as I said, it's a blessing to have to care for someone else in the midst of tragedy, that maybe she benefited from kind of being strong for you a little bit? Just a wild guess. If that's not right, that's not right.
No, I don't. I really don't know, Paul. I don't. I mean, I certainly don't want to take any credit for her attitude and for her throughout the whole process, her attitude and the way she approached it. Because, to me, it was all her. I mean, I drew a lot of strength from her, and I'm sure she may have from me as well, but. But I don't want to take credit for that. I mean, she was the one that did it. I mean, she's the one that went through all of the stuff. And but that certainly could be the case, yeah.
And before we move on, just to give listeners something actionable, right, that they can take with them from this conversation in their own lives, when someone's faced with adversity like this, the gravity of this, or perhaps their loved one is diagnosed with stage 4 cancer or cancer as well. Is there any advice you could give them? I mean, you've really been through it. Is there anything you maybe would have done differently or something that really helped you that you would recommend they do as well?
Oh man, done differently. I think about that a lot, Paul. I think about, man, did I do things the right way? Did I do things that made her, you know, while she was here, comfortable or happy, or, you know, and I don't know if I would have done anything differently per se. The advice I would give is what we talked about a little bit ago, is it really is, you know, live each day to the fullest. And that sounds very cliche. But there was times where, you know, she didn't feel so good. And we always tried to do a date night every week. And we really stuck to that. And there was days where I know she didn't feel well. I know she didn't. That's the last thing she wanted to do. But we did it anyway. Because, again, we go back to she didn't want cancer to rule her life. And so for me, probably live every day to its fullest. And not just that, but it's okay to be emotional. It's okay to show your feelings. It's okay to, you know, I found myself during that time, and even now more specifically, of showing my feelings a lot more, of telling people, you know, that I love them, telling people that I care about them, doing things spontaneously, because we don't know, right? I mean, there's no given set time that we know we're going to be here on this earth. I mean, we just don't know that. And things change, obviously, in a heartbeat.
Have you ever heard the Latin phrase, memento mori?
No.
No, I say that. That's probably my favorite thing to say to myself. I say it to myself probably 20 times a day. It just means remember your death. And I guess it goes way back to ancient Greece when the king would be like carried through the town. There'd be a guy that his job was just memento mori, over and over. So he doesn't get caught up in this lavishness. It's like, remember, you're going to die. And I read Steve Jobs' book too. And he gave this commencement speech and he said, if you live each day as if it were your last, one day you'll most certainly be right. And remembering that you're going to die is the best way I know of avoiding the trap of thinking you have something to lose. And to live in any other way, like to live and say, oh, this day's, you know, it's just another day. I can kind of waste it a little bit because my death is way far off. It's like precisely the wrong way to live. And so it seems that sometimes it takes an event like this to lead people to this, what I believe is ultimately true. I think it's completely true that you should live your life expecting your last day to like be pretty soon.
Yeah, I could not agree with that more. I mean, and there's, and at the very end here, I'll get into, to if we have time.
Oh, we got time. We got all the time in the world. Oh, you got a, what, you got a haircut?
No, that's not till after evening. So
okay, we've got plenty of time.
But because I want to talk a little bit about that too, of how my life has changed now, and kind of my outlook on it since this has happened, right? Hmm. But no, I could not agree more. I mean, I think that, you know, doing things that maybe are a little bit out of your comfort zone, doing things that you might not think about, because you're right. I mean, you can't just put them off. You can't say, oh, I'm going to do that, you know, next year or 10 years from now, or when you talked about retirement earlier. I'm going to wait till I retire to do that, because how do we know? We don't know, right? Yeah.
So your advice to people, again, would be, in a nutshell, like people that are going through something like this, what is your advice again? Is it to love people
I would say two part. I would say don't be afraid to show your emotions. Don't be afraid to tell people that you love them. And this is maybe a case by case basis too of people. But like especially a lot of my guy friends, right? Like I would never tell them prior to this, hey, I love you. But now I do because I think that's important. I mean, you need to know. People need to know that. And then I guess maybe my second advice, and this ties into the live every day, is say yes to things that you maybe wouldn't say yes to. There's a lot of times where I'm like, I don't know if I want to do that or not. And then I said, yeah, why not? And they turn out to be incredible experiences. And so a prime example of this, and this is no offense to you, Paul, but coming on the show today, I mean, this is tough for me to talk about, and, but it's important. And so to me, saying yes was important. So say yes more too.
Right. Well, it's been amazing thus far, and I can't say it's going to get easier right away. It might get a little harder before it gets easier here, but I'd like to ask now, I think you said three remissions, which is three like mini, hey, you can almost celebrate, which is in itself kind of tragic because it's all on like the way down, it seems like. So what happens after that third remission, which if I understand correctly, might have been the final remission?
No, I think there was maybe four in total. I like I said, Paul, I lost track, and I feel terrible, but it's such a blur for several years in there then. So ultimately what happened then was we got the news again that it had come back yet again a third time. And so the third time we started to look a little bit elsewhere, and we said, okay. And again, this was through some of the advice of the doctors at the cancer center, and so we said, okay, let's go to the premier location for cancer research, breast cancer research more specifically, and that's in Houston, Texas. And that's MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas. And so we had all lined up. Our doctor had sent in, her doctor had sent in a referral, and we had got lined up to go to Texas. And so we drove to Texas, and we went down there in hopes of finding maybe an experimental treatment, in hopes of finding, some new drug, some new chemo treatment, something that would you know, take it out for good. And when I talk about the second time being the hardest, this may have been right up there, if not even more so, because we had driven down there. We left very early in the morning. We drove 18 hours straight through. And I think it was a Sunday or Saturday morning. And then we get to MD Anderson Cancer Center. Our appointment was at, I think, 8 or 9 in the morning. It was very early in the morning. We met with the doctor. She went through a series of tests. She did another biopsy. And at that time, it was back in her liver. We did another biopsy. And then the doctor came in the room and within 2 hours said, yeah, we have nothing for you. And so that was heartbreaking, knowing that we had driven all the way to Texas. You have all these high hopes of saying, okay, this is the premier cancer center in the world. they surely have something. They surely have, you know, a trial treatment, a something that we can give a shot. And they didn't give us a reason why. They just said we don't have any trials for you right now. We recommend sticking with your current treatment plan from your doctor, and that's that. And so we drove all the way down there for that. So that was another tough one. And we didn't know what to do. I mean, at that point I said, well, what do we do? We had planned the whole week to stay down in Texas because we said, well, you know, we had planned many doctor's appointments and to hopefully get started on some treatment options. And within literally the first 2 hours, Paul, of being told no, that was pretty brutal. And so what we did was we had a conversation and said, well, we have an Airbnb for the week. We have a week down here. I'd taken off a week from work. She'd taken off a week from work. And so this goes back to, I guess, the earlier conversation too. And so what we did was we made the most of it. The first day sucked. I mean, there's no two ways to put that. But then we decided, okay, what we're going to do is we're already down here. Let's make the most of it. And so we stayed for a week in Texas and Houston, and we toured around and we did a lot of fun things, and we made it a vacation. And so, you know, taking advantage of the time that you have, we could have come back that day or the next day and been, you know, sad about it and upset. And again, going back to, you know, her attitude, because I immediately said, well, we should just go home. This is depressing. Let's just go home. And she said, no. She said, we're down here. We're going to make the most of this. Let's do it. And I'm so, so thankful we did that.
She's incredible. What in the world?
Paul, I can't even put into words how amazingly strong she was and her attitude and it's just unbelievable. And so she said, no, we're staying here. We're going to make the most of it. And I am so glad we did, Paul, because we had a great time. I mean, we did things, you know, we went to a Houston, Texas game or Texans game, and we went to the Space Center, and we went to museums and, you know, restaurants and bars. And we had a really good couple of days. And then actually what we did, too, was drove over from Texas to New Orleans and stayed in New Orleans for a couple of days because neither one of us had ever really been to New Orleans at that time. And so we drove over there and got an Airbnb for a couple of days and hung out there. And so we made a pretty great road trip of it. And so, again, I'm very, very thankful for that because we could have stayed there and, you know, wallowed in misery or came home and did the same, right? And instead, I have a lot of fond memories from that trip. So I look back at that trip of, the first day, don't want to go through that again. But the other days were very memorable, and we had a really good time. And so,
talk about responding with grace to that moment. That's incredible. Yeah. And I can't help but think, you know, these four, I think of it like a roller coaster. Four remissions is a lot of up and down.
Yeah.
I mean, high highs and low lows. That's too much.
Yeah.
Like, that'll drive anyone crazy, make anyone sick at least. And okay, though, so after that great little trip, it seems almost like, from how I see it, it's like, was that a bit of an acceptance moment?
I think so, because I think at that point, you know, of course we were devastated. We were anticipating good news. We were anticipating, oh yeah, sure, we have this new treatment that you can take that, you know, has a really high success rate, and you know we can help you. And again, they didn't really give us a reason why. But that's the way it is. I mean, I don't know why they didn't. But yeah, I think at that point we had said, okay, well, let's live our life. And we did. And so, I mean, I think that certainly was, and then maybe that's a really good word to use is the acceptance part to that. So then we came back home and went through treatment again. And I think, and again, the timing on this, I can't remember dates and you know, years even, and because the remission period started getting shorter and shorter, Paul, and I guess as the cancer started getting more aggressive, that's the reasoning behind that. The first one was a year, second one was 9 months, and I think the third one was maybe 3 months.
So cancer gets more aggressive. That's how it works.
Her type certainly was. Her type is a very aggressive type, and so the inflammatory type breast cancer is one of, and again I don't want to misspeak, but I think it's one of the most aggressive types of breast cancer, and so her type certainly was, you know, it got progressively more aggressive, because cancer tends to mutate over time, and that's how it beats the system, so to speak, or beats the chemo. And that's also why they change up chemos. She went through 6 or 7 different chemos. And the reasoning why is because some cancers can then become immune to certain chemos because they mutate. It's similar Weird. To the COVID situation, right?
Where right. Watch know, it. Don't.
Well, sorry.
No, you're good.
Don't want to bring that up.
I just had
up,
an but, episode get taken down because we. So anyway. Use a code word or something.
The recent situation, health situation in the world,
right?
Where we hear of mutations, and that's exactly what happens with certain cancers is that they may mutate, they become immune to certain chemos, and so we have to change it up and use a different chemo. And it gets a lot more complicated. There's, you know, certain receptors on cells that, there's various antigens or something like that that's on the cells that also complicate the matter. So yeah, there's a variety of different factors that go into that.
But, it sounds almost like a literal fight. The word fighting cancer, it sounds completely correct because it's like if you're in a boxing match and someone keeps hitting you with the same move, you're going to start dodging it.
Yeah.
And your only hope is to get a knockout in. But you're going to have to start throwing like combinations and stop throwing your same left hook because otherwise the cancer is going to figure it out, become immune to that. And it's apparently has a mission to like kill. It's crazy. It's almost like an evil thing, which is why I spoke about it before we hit record. There's almost this attitude of like hating cancer, which makes perfect sense. It seems like only a bad thing. Is there any good that I'm throwing a lot at you? Sorry, but it's just ridiculous. Like, what kind of thing is this?
That's exactly right. Is that, you know, changing up the strategy, because ultimately, if you stick with the same chemos or same treatments, cancer will find a way to outsmart it. And so that was one of the reasons why. And, The good we'll get to later.
Sure.
I've learned a lot from it, because you know in her case, you know, watching her struggle and just battle for so long, and you know I even struggle using the word battle, but you're right that it is very analogous to what happens. I mean, your body literally goes through a battle, you know, each time you take chemo of you know I can't imagine the internal struggle, internal even on the cellular level, right? Of the chemo attacking the cancers and then killing some of the other cells or decreasing the growth of other cells, such as, you know, hair cells, for example. It's pretty difficult.
And then also the psychological component of it, as you alluded to earlier, is if you're not in the right mindset, it can affect you negatively biologically.
Yes.
Neurologically, but like your immune system.
Absolutely, and we got to know a lot of folks, unfortunately, obviously through the Cancer Center, that were fighting similar battles or other battles, and some of them didn't have quite the same mindset, and unfortunately lost their battles as well, and I really truly wonder if that's a large part of it, and I you know, this, like you said, the science backs it up, and I certainly think that probably is the case.
Mm-hmm. So you return back to Illinois and you continue with the same program.
Yeah. So returned back to Illinois, went through different chemos, and then the long battle started. And again, I may be off on the dates and timings because in my head too, I want to say that we went to Texas twice, but I don't think we did.
Whoa, that's a big detail to. It must have been a real blur.
Yeah, and that's what I mean, Paul, because there was a stretch of a couple years in there where there was so many treatments and so many different things that happened. And I want to say we either at least went to Texas twice or we, at the very least, consulted them again the second time. The first time we went was the time where they told us no. And I want to say if we didn't go down again, it's such a blur. I think we only went once, but the second time we consulted on them and said, hey, and they said, no, we have nothing again. And then, yeah, and then things got progressively worse. And kind of the ultimate, as things started to get worse and worse, obviously the cancer started spreading. And so then she never did really fully go back into remission. So I think it was four times she was in brief remission. Cause she underwent treatment, I believe, five different times. And the last time things got pretty rough. Because she, we were at home one evening, and again, she never, ever, ever complained. And I could tell she was always, I shouldn't say always, but especially after chemo, was in pain and was, obviously not feeling well. But she never, ever complained. And, so there was one night she got pretty sick, and, she was in a fog, and things were bad things were happening. And I said, we need to go to the ER. And so we ended up going to the ER, and, again, throughout this whole process, never complained, went to the ER, and, she was having some pretty severe symptoms, really bad headaches and things. And so I explained to the ER doctor what was going on, and there's another story in there that I'm not going to tell, but ultimately what happened was is they ended up taking an MRI of her brain, and they found out that it had spread to her brain. And for me, that was probably when I knew that, you know, the remission is part of it. You have that hope. And then for me, I think that was the final, this is real. Sorry. Which sounds crazy to say that this is real, but that to me was a much more serious thing. So yeah, it was, that was tough. And then, but, classic Heather, she said, we're going to get through this. And, so it was crazy. And I don't think it's terribly common for breast cancer to spread to the brain. So a little fuzzy on those details, but so ultimately, 3 or 4 days later, she had brain surgery. And so add on to all of the other stuff she had to go through, add on all of the, you know, I cannot even begin to count the number of times she was stuck by a needle, that she had chemo, that she had treatment, that she had just test after test and biopsies. And then on top of all that, had to go through brain surgery. And so she, so they removed the tumor from her brain. And again, never complained. Never once said. And this is another thing that I don't understand, Paul, is that, you know, most people, I'm going to put myself in that category, I would probably question, why me? I would probably say, why is this happening to me, especially in your late 20s? You know, I mean, and never once did she say that. Never once did she say, why is this happening to me? Not a single time. So I told the story earlier of her, you know, complaining, and that was the only time she complained once was after brain surgery, because she had a bad reaction to morphine, and she was not herself, obviously, and she apologized for that. And I said, why are you apologizing? And she said, because I shouldn't have complained. And I said, but you just had brain surgery, like the pain and the everything that went with that. How could you not complain? And I said, it's okay. Like it's fine to complain. But yes, yeah, so that was kind of the beginning of the end. And that was rough. So that diagnosis was not expected, obviously. That was after the fourth remission, and then she never went back in remission after that. So
man, what then
happened after that? After she had the tumor removed. And if I know anything about brain surgery, it's not a great sight. Do they have to, like, shave her head and
remove
part of the skull? And
She was, she had, at that time, I don't know if she had hair or not. I can't remember at that time, but throughout most of this, she never had hair because of chemo. But again, her attitude, I mean, she started wearing wigs. She would name her wigs. And so, yeah, it was just, it was crazy. But yeah, to see, brain surgery is scary, obviously. And so to see that and to watch her go through that was really, really challenging. And thankfully they got most of it. And then, yeah, I mean, remove a piece of her skull and you know, go do what they do. And again, you know, I go back to this too, that the doctors here in town are incredible. I mean, we have one of the best neurosurgeons surgery department here in town. And so we're very, very thankful for that. I mean, a lot of people have to travel, you know, hours to get high quality treatment. And, you know, we have it right in our neighborhood. And so I cannot speak more highly of our doctors here in town, especially those people we interacted with, obviously. But I mean, and we talked to people who, you know, they would come from, you know, hours and hours away, and they couldn't, you know, they didn't have that option to be this close or have it in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And now I'm thinking too about treatment, Paul. I guess the second time was not Houston. It was in Chicago. So we went to Northwestern. So we went to Northwestern after the Chicago trip in hopes of finding the same thing, and we got turned down there too. So,
did you ever get mad about that? Like, throw a treatment, like a trial, anything at us?
I did, because of course you want something, right? You want the best you can get. You want to find that treatment that's the cure, right? And so, yeah, there certainly were times where I got angry. She didn't, but I did. And again, she would kind of talk me off the ledge. If I said, well, look, there's, you know, I get mad and say, well, why can't they help us? And why can't they do this? And then she'd say, well, look, this, you know, it's the way it's supposed to be, and they're doing the best they can.
It's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and she, I mean, that's... She was like, well, we have to just move forward and do what we can. And so, yes. Yeah, again, the attitude, Paul, I wish that I could have that attitude every day. I try, but there's certainly all days where I don't. But
okay, well, Paul, this is probably the most difficult part of the conversation, but as you obviously know, we're moving chronologically and we're almost towards the end. The sad ending of that story, and you say there's some good that comes from this somehow, but the end, I mean, people will want to know about this. Any advice or any sympathy you can send their way just from them listening to this might mean a lot to them. So I'm wondering if you could tell me about what the end was like, if that's okay with you, because look, that's going to be tough. I know that. It's going to be tough for me to even hear, but
yeah, I'll spare a lot of the details.
Sure, but, sure, please.
Yeah, so the end is obviously, well, one thing you can't plan for that. So we, very early on, especially after the second remission, in my head, I started to think about, okay, there's a very real possibility that she may lose her life due to this. And we talked about it often. And it sounds very strange, but I'm very, 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 very thankful that we did. Because again, cancer is a scary thing. Death is a scary thing to a lot of people. And I think that knowing your partner's or your loved one's wishes are incredibly important, because we talked about it quite a bit. Actually, we talked about, okay, if it comes to the point where you can't communicate to me what you want, what do you want? because we can assume, or we can think that we assume what our partners or our parents or loved ones or whomever needs or wants or their desires. But unless you have those conversations, you don't know. And we did, you know, have a will written up and a power of attorney and all of that stuff. And at a young age, again, that's really difficult to think about. But we did go through that process, and I'm so thankful we did, because we had to communicate, you know, what do you want? What are your wishes? And I'm very, very thankful we did. Yes, those were hard conversations. But especially once we got the no from MD Anderson and from Northwestern, and the brain cancer happened, or the brain tumor happened, then those conversations needed to happen. And so we started talking about that. You know, what are your wishes? What do you want to do? And what do you want to happen? And and, you know, again, I go back to this as a very young person, you know, in the early 30s, that's not something that you want to talk about. That's the very last thing you want to talk about. But I would urge people, if they are in that situation, or even if you're not,
if you're perfectly healthy, even,
you should have those conversations. It's not easy to talk about, because you think, well, like, you know, we talked about earlier that, oh, well, you know, my end of life is far off. Well, we don't know that, right? And quite frankly, that's led to conversations between, you know, my wife Lindsay and I now, about what our desires are, because it's very important. We need to know that. You need to know what happens if they can't communicate anymore. What happens? Do you want to be buried? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to? I mean, those are conversations that are not easy to have. But I guess when we talk about listeners, I mean, I would urge listeners to talk about that, have those conversations, because if you don't know, it becomes much more challenging. And as a matter of fact, so we'll get back on the timeline, and I'll tie this back in. So things got pretty worse. Or got worse pretty quickly. You know, she started to have cancer spread very, very rapidly. The brain tumors came back. There was buildup of calcium in her brain, which led to decreased mental function and physical function. And I'm very thankful, Paul, that it went quickly. I personally had you know, steeled myself for this. I thought I'd prepared myself, because at that time I knew what was going to happen. I knew the outcome. For years and years, I had hope. I thought maybe there's a different outcome. Maybe this is going to be, there will be some treatment come out that all of a sudden will, you know, be the miracle cure. And after the brain tumor and then things came back, I had prepared myself for this is the beginning of the end. And but even then, I still wasn't ready, because you just can't prepare yourself for that enough. And so ultimately what happened was, is she got very sick, went to the hospital. We went to the hospital. She was in ICU for a while. And then from the time she went into the hospital for the last time, she went in for the first time for 3 or 4 days. And then she got a little bit better. And then, a week or two after that, then things progressed pretty quickly. And then she was in the hospital, for about a week, and then she passed, October 24th. So a week from what today's Tuesday, a week from Monday. She passed away, and this next week will be 5 years. But even then, you know, I thought I'd prepared for that moment, but you really can't. There was a lot of very fuzzy moments in there. There was a lot of, I don't think I slept for 4 days.
Are you kidding me? That's pretty significant. 4 days.
Yeah, it was pretty draining. Because I had a lot of family and friends that would tell me, hey, you need to go home. You need to take a break. And I refused to leave her. I said, no, I'm not doing that. But that was important to me. So, yeah, I think it was 4 days I didn't sleep. And so things were a little blurry. But yeah, it was, It was tough. But yeah, you prepare yourself for it, but you really can't. And I knew it was coming at that time, right? And even then, even though I knew it was coming, I still try. I don't think I fully realized it. I don't think I fully understood it until I met with the oncologist that day, when things got to be pretty bad. And he looked at me and he said, "Do you know what this means?" And I said, "Yeah." And that was the extent of the conversation. And then at that time it then really fully did set in. But the knowing what your partner needs, I advocated for her very, very much, obviously. I knew what she wanted. I knew she didn't want to go on life support. I knew she wanted to be comfortable, because we had those tough conversations. And actually, as a matter of fact, Paul, I had a nurse come up to me afterwards, and she said, "I'm so proud of you." And I said, "For what?" And she said, "It's not very often that I see someone, a loved one, who advocates so strongly for their partner." And I said, "Well, I knew what she wanted." And so that actually made my decision-making easier, our decision-making easier. Her family was certainly involved in that. My family was involved in that, and it made our decisions much easier, because I knew what she wanted. I knew her wishes. I knew, because we had the tough conversations. And so it was hard, but I knew what she wanted, and I knew that I was, no matter what, I was going to stick by her wishes.
And as she said, as you alluded to earlier on, we have a game plan. You had a game plan.
Yeah. We did. I mean, she knew, she told me exactly how she wanted things to go. She told me very specifically, certain details, and I'm very glad she did. Because I wouldn't have known. I mean, imagine the stress of all of that on top of not knowing, okay, what does she want?
Right. Having to try to figure that out would be torture.
Exactly. And so knowing that was very, I don't want to say comforting, because there was no comfort in that, but knowing that gave me strength. It gave me strength to advocate for her in the manner of which I should have. Because people don't, and another reason I wanted to come on and talk today too is that people don't talk about, you know, the caretakers that much, and it's very challenging. It's hard to because of course, you know, I wanted her to be here for as long as possible, and I wanted to prolong her life, but that weren't her wishes. That was not her wishes. And so that was more important to me, to fulfill her wishes than me being selfish. And so I really tried hard to focus on that, and it helped.
Wow, man, you could picture in your mind how chaotic it would be if you were in that position and she passed and you didn't know what to do. And then everyone's asking you these questions. What do you want to do? What do we do for her? I don't know. It could really descend into chaos pretty quickly. So
yes,
it seems like the most responsible thing to do would be to discuss this with them beforehand.
Absolutely. And like I said, I mean, it's not a conversation that's easy. It's not a conversation that you want to have with, you know, a person, especially a young person. And those aren't easy. I mean, talking about death and talking about what your final wishes are not easy. And even so, Paul, this is how challenging it is that, you know, I lived through that, right? And my current wife, Lindsay, and I just finalized our wills last week. And that was five years ago. So even living through that, it was still tough to write down and say okay, what do I want? What do I want my final days to look like? Because you don't want to think about that. And you know, we talk about that now. I'm like, why did it take me so long? You know, that should have been something that everybody has in place. Your final wishes should be very clearly spelled out, because otherwise, you know, if nobody knows, if there is a sudden event, you know, it becomes a lot more challenging.
Hmm. The fact that you're able to sit and talk with me as well as you are now means that some things went right after that allowed for you to just recuperate mentally. Who was there for you at that moment at the hospital when Heather did pass? Were you able to lean on someone? Were there some pretty crucial people in your life at that time, support system?
Oh, absolutely. I have a very large family. They were all there. My parents were there. Her parents were there. Her family was there. Her sister and her husband and so many friends. And it was so there was a lot of people there for support. Absolutely. And they were all obviously fantastic. I mean, obviously they're grieving as well. And so and then, you know, that day she passed in the morning that day, then when I got home, you know, there was, you know, I can't even remember who all was at the house. And it was, you know, again, a lot of it is a blur. So many friends and family that were incredibly supportive, even though they were grieving too. And it really, really helped. I had friends of mine that would stop by just, you know, out of the blue and say, "Hey, I just want to stop by and see how you're doing." Or not even ask that question. Just stop by and say, "Hey, just want to hang out for a bit." You know, phone calls, text messages, you know, family, friends, all that good stuff. And certainly was helpful. But I'll be honest, Paul. I mean, you know, even I talk about, you know, mentally preparing, and when I talk about a lot of the process of her battle, that was a blur for you know, years. The month or two after, I quite frankly can't remember much at all, because I was in such a mental state that I just don't remember much, and so it was pretty tough.
Were you away from school and stuff during that time?
Yeah, actually, so I had started at ISU at that time, so I was working at Illinois State University, and they were absolutely incredible, Paul. I don't know many employers that would have done what they did, and they supported me wholeheartedly. The faculty that I work with, and the HR department, and I mean, everybody was just fantastic. I mean, they allowed me to take the time that I needed to properly grieve and to have time for myself, and so they were absolutely fantastic. I couldn't speak more highly of that. I've heard horror stories of you know, employees or employers being, you know, asking employees who have gone through similar things to come back in, you know, a week or two. And there's no way that I could have done that. There's not a chance I could have even been in a place where I could have done that.
How long were you gone? You might have just said that.
So I was out from October until January. Mm. So a couple months. And because there's no way I could have returned. I could not have been in a mental state to do what I needed to do,
right.
to perform my job the way I needed to perform my job. I could not have done that. So
perhaps the wisest investment we could make is who we surround ourselves with and who we make friends with. And
yes,
even of course they always say the biggest decision you make is who you marry, and but then their families also are going to be so important as well. And something, Paul, that people have asked me to ask you about, and I hope it's okay to ask, is did you talk about, you said you're married to someone, Lindsay, now, who's a wonderful person who I've had the pleasure of meeting. Did you and Heather talk about that beforehand?
Yeah, I laugh because yes. I mean, I will never forget this conversation. Because we had all these tough conversations, right? And I remember one day, we were talking about, you know, what happens after, and we were talking a lot more specifically about like our pets. For example, we had two dogs and a cat at the time, and then about, you know, kind of what my life would look like. And she said something that I got mad at, actually. And she said, "I want you to promise me that you're going to remarry." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Yeah." She said, I want you to promise me you're going to remarry." And I said, "No, I'm not promising that." I said, "Now, I promise that I'll be open to the possibility, but I said, I'm not going to remarry for the sake of remarrying. I said, I want to find, you know, the right person. I want to find, you know, somebody that is compatible with me and all of that good stuff, right?" And so I told her no about the promise part, but I said, I'll be open to it. And she said, I want you to be happy. And she said, I want you to find someone. And she's like, and she said, and then she agreed with me. She said, okay, if it's the right person, And she, and so, yes, we absolutely did talk about that. And so at the time I was mad at her because I was like, why would you ever say something like that? But then, yeah, I mean, so we talk about lessons learned and, man, I mean, I'm so incredibly blessed, lucky, whatever right now that, you know, I have obviously remarried. Lindsay's another amazing woman. She has helped me tremendously. I don't know, Paul, how I got, I say lucky twice. I really don't know that because I've had two incredible women in my life. And sometimes that doesn't, I mean, a lot of times that doesn't happen. And so, yeah, my lessons learned, you know, I kept myself open after that because, and I thought about that, like, do I really want to ever remarry again? And then I met Lindsay, and I mean, that was an obvious answer. But, but yeah, it's crazy. But it gave me a lot of courage to do that. It gave me a lot of, because, you know, I never did want to think about, okay, what should I do that? Should I not do that? By that, I mean, you know, continue other relationships. And, but that certainly gave me the strength and courage to do so. And then, yeah, I mean, my life now is obviously much different, but, Lindsay and I have a fantastic life and we get along great. We obviously have a good life together. And so I, you know, the good that's come, and that's the very strange part for me is that, you know, having Heather and then, it's always very, very weird for me to think about, well, I had Heather, but now also I have this other amazingly strong, beautiful, amazing woman. And so it's so difficult to think about that for me sometimes. I have never compared because I think that's unfair to both of them. But the fact that I've had two really amazing women in my life is, and had the opportunity to be married to two amazing women is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. But yeah, but we did have that conversation. And at the time I thought she was crazy. I thought that that's never going to happen again. And here, Lindsay and I just celebrated our 2-year wedding anniversary last week. So,
congratulations on that.
So, yeah. Thank you. It's life is weird, Paul.
Yeah, it is.
It's a very strange thing to go through. But.
Yeah, to say the least. Wow. And forgive me, I consider myself something like a journalist here. I want to give people some valuable insights. Was there difficulty in moving? I don't even know what the situation is, but you had a lot of Heather's belongings. I'm sure there was talk between you and Lindsay about this, but people are curious, right? How did you handle what you kept of Heather's when marrying?
That's a really good question. So actually, there's a couple.
Glad
parts
you think
to
so,
that.
And you didn't get mad.
No, that's a great question because. I want to talk about a few things with that, really, because when you talk about who I talked to, too, I did go through a year of grief counseling. And at first I thought to myself, I don't need that. Like, why do I need to talk to somebody? And I cannot stress enough how helpful that was. So I did a year of grief counseling. And then after that, I thought, okay, I'm cool. Like, I don't need to see anybody else again. I'm good to go. Well, and then 2 or 3 years, I think maybe it's 2.5-ish years after she passed, I went through a really tough spot. And so when I say some good, you know, good coming out of things, Lindsay helped me tremendously. She urged me to seek counseling. She urged me to go talk to people. And I did. And so that helped a lot. And so I went to counseling for, you know, just a therapist for that's been several years now. But that was a lot of urging from Lindsay of saying, hey, look, you need to go talk to somebody. You need to go. Because I tried really hard not to bring, you know, my past into our current relationship because, again, I don't think that's fair. And so the belonging stuff, I messed up on that. And I'll openly admit that. Part of this was that Heather was never really into many physical stuff. She's because I asked, we again, we had that conversation of, what should I do with your stuff? Like your clothes and your belongings. Like, what do you want me to do with that? And, she was like, I don't really care. Like, do whatever you want to with it.
They're just clothes to her.
Exactly.
Because they're her clothes. Sure.
Exactly. It was just clothes. She's like, I don't really care what you do with it. Do whatever. And so, but where I messed up, Paul, was I didn't think about, because then what happened was, I was living by myself in our house, and then I had started dating Lindsay, and she would come over, and there were still pictures of myself and Heather up, and I didn't think about that enough, so I messed up there, because I, and we've, Lindsay and I have since talked about it, that, you know, I made a mistake, because I made Lindsay feel uncomfortable, but I don't know, you know, fully what her thought process was, because I can't put myself in her shoes, much like I'm sure she can't put herself in mine. But then I started realizing, look, I mean, changes kind of have to happen and things have to happen. And so there certainly are some mementos and other things that we've kept and I have, but the vast majority of it was donated, or given away to other people. And, so yeah, but early on I didn't handle it well. Cause then I thought, oh, I'm not going to be that person that, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road that I have pictures hanging up or whatever. Well, here, you know, over a year down the road, I was that person. And then I had to realize that I wasn't being fair to Lindsay at the time. And that really set me back. And I still feel bad about that. I really do, Paul. Because I try not to compare. I try to be fair, and that was not fair to her.
So if you could go back, you would have, taken those photos down?
I think I would have been more open and honest with Lindsay. I don't think I was open enough with her at the very beginning. And this is what I mean by, you know, lessons learned of opening up to people and being very transparent with them. And she obviously knew I had been widowed, and but we didn't really talk too much about it. And I should have really been, you know, I should have asked her if she was comfortable. I should have asked her, like, hey, are you okay with it? And if she wasn't, then I had made concessions to make sure she was comfortable. And I didn't do that, and that was I regret that. I don't regret too many things, but I do regret that. I made her uncomfortable, and that was on me.
Did she say something right away about it?
No, she didn't right away, but that certainly came up afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so I apologized to her, but even then, that's not enough. I mean, I made her feel uncomfortable in a position where she shouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. And now we don't talk a lot about, you know, my past and things like that, but she obviously certainly is aware of it. She's been a comfort to me. She certainly has been very beneficial in urging me to seek, you know, mental help and things like that I probably wouldn't have on my own. And so she's been a very big advocate for that. And there's times, you know, where admittedly I'm in a weird state or a weird mood, and she'll say, I really think you need to go see your doctor. And she's right. And so, you know, again, having that really supportive person in your life to help you is important.
Right.
But
man, well, Paul Meister, as we wind down this whole thing, I mean, so much was talked about, so many important things, so much good advice also from, first of all, if you're a man and come from a true man's man like yourself, you know, 7 foot tall, meat cooker guy, athlete, professor. I mean, to tell people to be transparent with their feelings and don't be scared to show their emotions, especially their positive ones, especially telling people they love people, that's huge. Talk about these difficult things with your loved one, especially if you're married or planning on being married. Talk about them now. Your wisdom and insight gained, just the sheer inspiration that you can get from hearing the stories of Heather's continued positivity, as insane as it seemed. All the other things you said, it's really been a marvelous conversation. Then what I just asked you about moving on, that's something that I haven't heard anyone talk about. So I truly appreciate your willingness to go there with me. And as we wind this whole thing down, is there anything else that you want to say to the listeners, to maybe to people that are newly diagnosed with cancer even, or people that are with someone they love who has cancer, or maybe just people like me that thankfully aren't in that situation but might be one day, is there anything you want to say before we wrap things up?
Sure. I could talk for hours, obviously, as you know, but I think the one thing that I would say is that you have to find what works for you. And again, that sounds very cliche and dumb, but everybody's situation is so different. Everybody's battle with cancer is so different. Everybody's relationship with each other or with, you know, the loved ones around them is different. And so it's very, very hard to find, you know, the one thing that works for everybody. Cause I really don't think that there is that one thing. You have to find what works for you, surround yourself with people that you love, get a good support cast, because that means everything in the world. Just in general, I think too, one thing that I really want to point out too, for like you said, people like me, if you know someone that loses someone, a loved one or a friend or a coworker or whomever, just be real with that person. I've had so many people that, especially in the direct period after that she had passed, that I could tell weren't really truly genuine, and they didn't know what to say, and they didn't know how to approach, because it's very hard. And again, even living through that, I still don't know what to say to people sometimes. And so be genuine in your comments or thoughts to those people, especially if they're struggling. And one thing too that I urge people not to do is please don't say, I know what you're going through, because that really irritated me, because everyone's different. Everyone's situation is different. I know a lot of people now, unfortunately, who have lost loved ones, or who are battling cancer or whatever it may be. And I don't know what they're going through, even though I've been through, you know, some pretty harsh times, but I still don't know that.
Cause you're not them.
Exactly.
There's so many, they're living an entirely different life with entirely different characters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you just have to be real and just, I mean, be genuine with those people and you know, just try not to compare. Try not to say, oh, I know what you're going through or whatever that may be. Because again, I mean, that's, everybody's different. Everybody's situation is unique. And but also while we wrap up, Paul, I do want to thank you for allowing me to share my story. And I hope that, you know, if anybody has any, that can take anything from this, you know, that maybe it's a little something that I said that maybe brings any comfort to them or whatever. But and also put out there that if anybody does want to talk to me personally, you can feel free to reach out to me. You can post my email, I guess, if you want.
What is it? If you really want me to put it out.
Yeah, no, I'm serious, because I think talking to people, just having that sense of community of people that have gone through it, or I don't have any advice for people in that sense, but sometimes just talking to somebody who's gone through something similar is powerful. But yeah, my email is pameist@ilstu.edu. And you can find me on the ISU website. But yeah, I'd be happy to chat or connect with anybody who does have questions or who wants to reach out. Absolutely.
Perfect. And I just got to ask, did anyone ever tell you that they know what you're going through? Or they understand?
Yes.
Yes. More than one?
Yes. And especially right after. And there's a lot of other things that are said that irritate me, but I'll save those for some other time. but yeah, people, so I understand what you're going through, or, you know, and that's not a good thing to say to someone who's grieving or someone who's going through the process, or even, you know, a recent diagnosis, because you really don't. I mean, it's just not the same for everybody.
I recently had this couple on that lost their 21-year-old daughter. She drowned, actually, and the dad tried to save her, and it was really a heartbreaking thing, and it was only like a year and a half ago that it happened. They came on the show, and they said, because I asked, you know, what do you want people to say to you? Let's just put it like that. And they said for them, sometimes the best thing that they've heard is, there are no words.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not even, I'm sorry for your loss.
Right.
There are no words. Yeah. And I even tried that out with someone who just lost someone very close to them, because, you know, I'm face to face with them. They know I know, and I, of course, know what they just lost.
Right.
And I'm like, there are no words. Yeah. And she said, You're right. That's right. Yeah. There are no words.
Yeah.
Would you say that's an okay thing to say, maybe? If
yeah.
you're just telling someone to, if they don't know what to say, what could they say?
Absolutely. And I actually saw, I'll tell you my favorite response, Paul, and I get goosebumps talking about it, really, because you do get the I'm sorry's and the other cliche statements.
Yeah, what are you supposed to say to that, by the way? Well, I'm sorry, thank you.
Right, and that's the struggle I had is when people say, well, I'm sorry, well, I never knew how to respond, right? And so, and again, ultimately, it's because we don't know how to talk about it. We don't know how to approach this because I didn't know. And again, even to this day, you know, I still find myself slipping up at times when I have a student or someone that I know who loses a loved one. And, you know, I often find myself saying, I'm sorry. And because that's kind of the thing to say, right? But my best response or my favorite response, and I'll never, ever forget this, I was having lunch at Kemp's in Lexington, and a friend of mine came up to me, and she looked at me, and she just came up and gave me a big hug, and she said something that I can't repeat on air, but she also said exactly that. She said, I have no words, and so I'm just going to walk away, and that's what her comment was, and that to me was the most powerful, because again, it was genuine. It was, she didn't know what to say. She didn't, there was nothing that she knew there was nothing she could say in the moment that would, you know, comfort me or to, you know, whatever. And so I thought that was to me the most powerful. She just said, I don't know what to say. So I'm just going to give you a hug and walk away. And I thought that was probably the most powerful comment anybody said to me. You know, especially out in the community or when you're out in public. But again, it's hard. I mean, people don't know what to say.
That's a pretty good blueprint, though.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Paul Meister, your vulnerability. I mean, you practice what you preach, sharing your emotions. And I've always said that's, first of all, bearing the weight of an untold story is really difficult. And not only that, but when you do share it, as you have today, it's so beneficial to other people. It's amazing what good can come from just coming onto a podcast and telling your story. So thank you so much. I respect it a lot, and I really had a good time with this, and I know it's going to be really meaningful to people.
Well, thanks so much for having me again, Paul. I truly appreciate it. Thanks for letting me share my story.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, and thank you everyone for watching and listening to this episode of The Paul Garcia Show. Until next Sunday, I'm your host, Paul Garcia. That was Paul Meister. God bless, and have a great week. And this is probably the weirdest wrap-up I've ever done of any live episode, but I got to say a quick thank you to Marshalloni's Pizza in Fairbury, Illinois. If you call between 4 and 5 p.m. and order a pizza, you'll get the second one of equal or lesser value for free. Restrictions apply, and then you can come pick it up at any time after that before 8 p.m. Call between 4 and 5, get your pizza anytime after that before 8 p.m. Marshalloni's Pizza, best pizza probably in the world. And again, Paul Meister, thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Of course, that's a wrap.